Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike, and today's interview is with Ian Crosby. Ian is the CEO and founder of Teal Platforms, and previously co-founded and led Bench Accounting, from founding to become the largest small business accounting service in America. Welcome, Ian.
Thanks.
I'm excited to have you here and to dig in. We had a good conversation a few weeks ago, and within like two or three exchanges, you said something where it made me think. And that's always, when somebody says something that makes me think, it makes me like, oh, I want to talk more about this, right? I want to dig in.
I'm glad. Yeah, you really hooked on to my words about boring competence. So I'm happy to talk more about it.
Yeah, I'd never before heard someone say, I want to hire people for boring competence. And I immediately wanted to know more about that, to the point that I'm like, let's get that as one of the topics on the show. So before we dig into that, and also obviously like lessons learned building Bench and now Teal, I want to give you a chance to sort of recap, summarize your story so far as you like to tell us, that kind of gets us to have a little bit of context for people listening about who you are and where you've been, so to speak.
Grew up in Vancouver, Canada. First job, I mean, I had, you know, the first teenager jobs that were very formative, but the first, you know, professional job was a bookkeeper. And then I graduated university and went to work for a Bain & Company as an associate consultant. And then after 2 years, had this idea about, why is there not a better way to get your bookkeeping done as a small business? Like, how the heck was I your best option as like hiring a business student to do your finances for you? So, you know, just convinced two of my best friends to, let's all drop what we're doing and go work on this thing, which is, we're just going to go and try and solve bookkeeping for small businesses. My first business, I must have been 23, 24 at the time. And then I didn't think I would spend 10 years working on it, but I ended up spending 10 years working on it, growing it from, you know, learning everything. It had never written software before, didn't really know what SaaS was. And this was 2012, so I guess a lot fewer people know what SaaS was. It's not like you could even really Google it and get a ton. But built that business. And then Shopify actually was our biggest distribution partner. And I built a great relationship with them. And then, so when I was done, actually, you know, they reached out to me and said, hey, would you be interested in running our banking division? So I said, okay, you know, that sounds interesting. And I've never had a real, you know, real job before other than when I was 22 working as associate consultant. So let's go see what that's about.
Very different scale and scope now.
Yeah. And also respected the hell out of Kaz and Toby over at Shopify. So, you know, let me soak in whatever I can from them. I've never really had a mentor. I'd always been kind of figuring out myself. Went there for just under a year and a half, started running banking, and then, you know, took on more stuff, lending, ecosystem payments. So like app store payments. And when I left, I was running the financial services division, so that entire group. So I got a lot of visibility really fast into how that business operates and how financial services operates and all that kind of stuff. But one thing that we really struggled with, one thing that I wish that we could launch, was our own accounting, which wasn't really feasible because there was no infrastructure layer that we could really use. Like, we wanted to launch banking, there's banking as a service players. You can use Unit, you can use Stripe, you know, like there's a way of doing this. If you want to launch lending, there's lending as a service. If you want to launch cards, there's, you know, there's all these things where, you know, there's some hoops to jump through, but there's a way of doing it. If you want to launch your own accounting that's bundled into the rest of your offering, it's just not really possible. Like, there were some players, but it was really, it was clear that it wasn't a thing yet. There were like 10-year-old companies trying to do it that had never, you know, gotten more than like 15 employees. Like, no one had really cracked it. Like, banking had been cracked or lending had been cracked. And I realized, okay, so now we're at the point where, you know, there's scaled vertical SaaS players. That wasn't true 10 years ago. Like, Shopify is sort of the front of the pack, and you've got ServiceTitan and all these sort of, you know, businesses that are built around a very particular niche vertical. Do a great job at having you run your core business. Jobber is actually a great Canadian example. Clio here in Vancouver. And then, you know, you figure out how to monetize that with financial services. So typically it's payments. And then you know, get deeper into the stack. You know, banking being the latest thing. Lending is huge. And accounting is a pretty big part of that business in a box. Like, it's noticeable that everyone is taking all of their financial service data, they're throwing it over to QuickBooks, and struggling with doing it, you know, despite the fact that, you know, you might be your customers
credit card, bank, and payments, you still don't know what their profitability is. You still don't know what the cash flow is because all of that data is being interpreted elsewhere.
I mean, every small business needs that. 100% of them need accounting.
Yeah, exactly. And to boot, you're saying it over to a player that their entire revenue roadmap is the same as yours. So like QuickBooks' revenue roadmap is also payments and payroll and banking and cards. So, you know, you're helping them build their competing business. So this is a big problem for, you know, vertical SaaS at large. Now that vertical SaaS sort of is a thing and it's at the maturity level that it is, these companies need the ability to offer their own accounting suite, and it just wasn't there. So I realized, oh, I'm probably the best person in the world to go launch this. You know, I wish I could have been a customer of it. So I have, you know, my desire for like, here's exactly how it would work and here's what it would offer and here's how it would work with the other services. And then I also have the experience of here's how accounting needs to work, building both the software and the service side and deeply understanding Intuit and QuickBooks and their strengths and weaknesses. So I realized that there's a pretty narrow Venn diagram overlap of people with sort of the right combination of experience to start this company and make it massively successful. So that's probably a thing I should do. I was actually almost a little sad when I came to that realization. Sad and excited. Excited because I'm like, oh, this is going to be huge. Sad because I'm like, I thought my next company would not be in accounting.
Right.
I've spent enough of my life doing accounting stuff. Like, let's go on a new adventure. You know, turns out that all the experience actually made me the perfect person to recognize the opportunity.
So it's a challenge, and it's come up with a few of the founders we've had on the show and talking to them. When they're thinking through what they're going to start next, there's always a pull to something totally new and uncertain. And like, oh, what if I can fix, I don't know, housing, some totally thing that they have no context for. But a really common loop is when you really get into, especially once you're in mid-career, you have a bunch of strengths and skills and knowledge and connections. And to just not use them all is often a pretty big opportunity cost. And so there's probably something out there that leverages, like we had Dennis Pelerinos on the show, and he built something in developer tools and then investigated a bunch of things. And then it's like, what does it make sense to build again? Something not the same, but that leverages a bunch of those skills and connections. So it's a common loop I think many founders go through.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously, building Bench from zero to hundreds of employees, the biggest small business accounting company in the US, you're going to learn a lot. And especially because you started in your like 23 and you'd never had a real kind of real job like that and in that industry. So obviously there's lots of things that you learn, but can you think of like a big lesson from that time that's something that you'd absolutely, you know, would do again or are doing again? And then a lesson that sort of showed you something that you maybe wouldn't do differently or you're not going to do the second time around?
I mean, I spent 10 years at Bench and that was like my formative leadership experience. So there's just so much stuff there, understanding that it all really comes down to people. Like as soon as you hire two people, you are the minority doer of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are majority relying on the actions of others. And so what are the skills of those people? How are they motivated? What's their, you know, what's the culture of the group? Like those things become way more important than, you know, what you're going to wake up and do at 9 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And how you influence that group, how you build that group. So, I mean, I kind of, if you list off, you know, a leadership mistake, I've probably made it. hiring the person because it looked like they had the perfect resume and, you know, hiring the person because they had so much potential, and you know, you can go to either extreme and they're both, you know, not a good idea. Yeah. Learning how to set a culture, learning how to design it. There's so many sort of shibboleths around company culture that float around the internet. This is terrible, but I spend way too much time on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Like getting hammered by like Thinkfluencers and just going like, oh my God. Like, and then, you know, look at the comments like, oh my God, 100% this. And you're just like, this is all stuff that sounds good and it's not going to actually work to do it at scale and to make a successful company. A lot of stuff is just people have to be good at their jobs, and no one's writing Thinkfluencer posts around like, you know, if you want to have a successful company, everyone should be really competent at the exact thing that they do. And that should actually be probably one of the most important things. Like people should just be good at their job, not like we wanted this amazing retreat or like all these, there's all these feel good things. And it's like, okay, like I'm glad that you feel good, but that's not like what kind of company are you trying to create? You know, are you trying to create one where it's like people just feel good all the time, but it doesn't really accomplish much, you know, or are you trying to like really go for it and build something huge? And a lot of people are pretending that they're trying to build something huge, but they're not. And it's almost like they don't know that they're not.
When you say that they're not, you mean you don't, they don't, they're not actually building something huge, but they feel like they are, or they're, that's their, the vision that they pitch, but it's all kind of an illusion. Is that what you're saying?
I don't want to speculate as to why. Mm-hmm. You know, I can talk about why I did the same thing, right? Where I'm like, here's how you build a company culture. And there's all these posts, and I look back at Bench, and I'm just like, oh man, some of those things I did, especially in the early years, I'm like, please let those fade into history. Why do those have to be saved forever on the internet? You know,
you mean, when you say things you did, you mean like a post or a some way that you immortalized the way you were thinking at the time about culture.
Yeah, exactly. And it's almost like, you know, I don't know if you think back to high school and like some of the things you did said, and you're like, I'm glad no one remembers that, you know? And yeah, I definitely feel that way about some of the things that, you know, I put out there about Bench, because we're definitely at some points drinking the startup Kool-Aid. A lot of those things actually blew up in our faces and didn't work at all.
You mentioned like hiring bad hires, but like in terms of like cultural or initiatives to try and, because you've expressed an importance of designing and being thoughtful about the culture you're building, but and then, you know, different leaders will make attempts to try and form that culture. It sounds like some of those attempts didn't get the results that in retrospect you might have wanted.
Probably the biggest one was just not telling people, hey, we're the number one thing we're trying to do here is build a successful, profitable business. And I don't even want to use the word successful, because people hear that word and then they map their own version onto success. I'm like, economically successful, lots of revenue and profits, and like a healthy profile of growth, like that should actually be really important.
Mm-hmm.
And it is almost like this, like, ooh, like it needs to be bigger than profits thing that goes around the internet. It's always got to be this big, massive thing. It's like, well, if it's not making a massive amount of profit, did you actually change anything? Like,
well, you could imagine in theory, not to like, obviously OpenAI is a weird example of this, but you could imagine creating a nonprofit. Like Wikipedia changed stuff. It's possible to change things without being massively profitable.
Well, actually, OpenAI, let's take the example of OpenAI. Does anyone think that Microsoft is not going to make billions upon billions of dollars on their OpenAI investment? Like, that's a sign that they're actually doing something in society that is economically valuable, that's changing something really fast. By the way, I totally get your pushback on this concept, by the way, because this is like the conception, and that I totally was spouting the same thing for a long time. Profit's not the most important thing. Don't be so short-sighted. If you're really thinking about changing society, it's like people don't, like if you think about the companies most successful, like Stripe, mm-hmm. everyone talks in hushed tones about Stripe and think incredible execution. Yeah. And one of the measures of that is think of how much money they're making. If Stripe, it was like, it's a cool business, but it's not, you know, it doesn't really make that much revenue or profit, but it's a really cool technology. Like that's not, people wouldn't talk about it the same way. People wouldn't understand it in the same way, right?
Is that true? Like, I think I've definitely thought of examples of, there was companies like Uber at its height of impact, or I mean, maybe it's not the height of its impact, but the height of it, the hype around it as a business. It was unprofitable, had never been profitable. It had a huge impact in terms of it, like put huge economic impacts on the way that other operators, it's just totally disrupted by any definition of disrupted an entire business, and also changed the way that a lot of people live their day-to-day life. But it, actually, for a while, there was a curiosity of like, is this even a business that can exist? Like, it may actually not just be unprofitable, but like infeasible. It turns out, it seems like maybe it's turning a corner. It's like, actually, it is possible to turn that into a business. But it seems like the impact came way before the profit.
Uber makes billions of dollars in profit. And we can quibble about, should they have done it better? But like, yeah. I don't think either of us would be like, I could have done Uber better, right? Like, it's, and part of the reason that we would respect the hell out of Uber's execution is because if it went the way of Bird, you know, which also, you know, everyone's like, Bird, you know, like this was foolish. Whoever thought that those scooters would work? And why we laugh about it? Because it's like, it had a cultural impact. People talked about it, but it's not a sustainable business. It grew really fast and then died really fast. And it's kind of nothing burger now, right? So,
yeah. And I think that is the thread that I think resonates more easily with people, I find, and with me personally, obviously I'm just one person, is that you need to be profitable, at least like nominally profitable to keep existing.
Yeah, absolutely.
We can go around and have the company culture that's everyone that's amazing and we're all sipping pina coladas as we burn through VC cash. But at some point, the company will stop existing unless it is profitable. Now, the difference between massively profitable and nominally profitable, you know, it provides some additional bonuses, like maybe we can hire really awesome people, or maybe we can, you know, it opens up more opportunities. But that feels like the huge state change when it's like, are we default alive or not?
Yeah, sure. And that's very important. Absolutely. That's a pretty low bar, in my opinion.
You would think.
You know, when I'm talking about what does success look like, it's like, let's talk about Stripe and Uber and those kind of companies, right? And like, that's something that we weren't really talking about at Bench. Mm-hmm. And like, I eventually realized like, oh, you should really hire people who, like, talking about winning is not a dirty word, mm-hmm. you know? And like, what does it really mean to win? Yeah, let's be ambitious. Let's build it. Like, if you could go build an Amazon, why would you not build an Amazon?
So Bench got to the point where it was the largest small business accounting platform in America. Is that a win? Or is that kind of a point of an example of your mindset? It's like, yeah, maybe we built something that was large, but if it wasn't necessarily at some points profitable, then what's the point of it having been built that large? Or is that the path that just took longer to get to because you didn't have as much of that mindset as maybe you could have at some point?
I want to love all of my children.
I'm not trying to trap you here.
Like, if I had been thinking differently in the early years, Bench could have been way more successful than it is. Mm. There's lots of people who know Bench, talk about Bench, and respect Bench. And it's great being in the small business sphere when, like, most people have heard about Bench. They're like, oh, yeah, Bench is great. But it's not a Stripe. You know, it's not a Shopify. And, you know, I spent almost as much time building Bench as Toby spent building Shopify. And yet he mm-hmm. built a company that's 1,000, 10,000, however many times bigger.
Yes.
There's a lot of zeros there, right? And so I get really curious about, interesting, he spent his time doing something that had a different outcome. What are the differences there? Mm-hmm. You know, that's actually why I went there to work there. I'm like, Lex, what's the difference?
How was that experience? Like, a lot of founders go through this loop where they found a company, maybe really early on, like you and I both found our first like meaningful company in our 20s, early 20s. And then a lot of founders end up on this path where it's like, well, okay, what do I do after this? I guess I'm going to found another company. Everyone just kind of assumes, okay, now you see your serially founding company and that's what your resume is, a series of companies you founded, or maybe you retire at some point. How did you find that experience of going in and like, okay, now you have a boss now. You're in a large org that you didn't design.
One thing I did discover is I'm not compatible with employment. Like, it is really hard for me to have a boss. Absolutely. Whether that's a personality flaw or a learned behavior. If I reflect back actually my time of being a company, I think I felt the same. That's why I ended up starting a company. So it's probably a little more hard-coded. I almost wish that I could be happier being an employee, because it was an uncomfortable experience, to be totally honest. I think we do a lot of great work. There's a lot to be proud of. And I learned a ton. And I respect the hell out of everyone I worked with. But at the same time, there's a reason that I left. And it was because, like, you know, I think just being an employee is not for me. Otherwise, I'd still be there.
Yeah, that's the mindset I hear from, if not a lot, like I've made probably most of the founders that I talk to is some variant of either I fundamentally know that I am not a good employee, or I eventually figured out that that's just not the way I'm set up.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of a much better setup than what I had at Shopify, and I still could not really hack it. And I was honestly, I had this kind of like, how can I honestly be unhappy with my situation? Like, are you kidding me? Like, with myself, because it was going so incredibly well in every dimension, and yet I'm like, I have to go do a different thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the things fundamentally that most people who are successful struggle with at some point in their middle of their career is, past me would think that I currently have maximal success. Why am I not 100% happy? How can I possibly not just be basking in the glow of this wondrous success by whatever definition I would have had 10 years ago?
Yeah, exactly. At the same time, I'm super glad I did it.
Yeah.
Just like having the opportunity to see how someone else has done it, how that company operates, and seeing what a really incredible business model looks like. Mm-hmm. Like Shopify, you know, full disclosure, I'm a very happy shareholder and like believe in that business. Just the power of the business, it's just so ridiculous. Like, I don't think people actually realize how Shopify is just starting still and how much further it has to go on so many different dimensions. and just seeing why, like, what is the secret sauce here? And going like, oh, like to have a successful product there, like once you're on this vertical SaaS business model, like people want to buy things from Shopify, right? Shopify sellers, they love Shopify so much. You're like, hey, we're going to launch banking now. They're like, great, I'll use it.
Yeah.
You're not like, hey, here's the 10 reasons why you should leave your bank. You don't need to tell that to a Shopify seller. They're like, Shopify's doing it, I'm buying it. Because I assume it's going to be really well integrated with everything else. It's going to be really competently designed. There's going to be great customer service. Quite frankly, I just like Shopify.
Yeah.
You know, you're going up against like a legacy bank. They're like, do they feel that about Wells Fargo or Bank of America or any of these other folks? No, right? So, and then you've already acquired the customer. Like this is the magic of vertical SaaS, is like they're already using you. You've already paid your customer acquisition cost, and then you can just build and launch more and more products that each individually are incredibly profitable. Payments, banking, all these kind of things, cards. And you get to acquire all this profit at no marginal cost of acquisition, you know, versus like at Bench, every time we go get a customer, it's like, hey, I'm going to go get a new customer and sell them accounting. And I have this one add-on, which is like tax services. And then you're done. Like there's not like 10 other things or 100 other things I can sell them because my customers are so spread out across 100 different verticals. Like we're too horizontal, right? Versus, you know, if you're really built around the needs of one business, you can go, what do e-commerce sellers need? Or if you're in home services, you know, what do roofers need? Like, let me go stand next to a roofer and see what would make managing his or her business easier.
Yeah.
Great business models are one where you don't have to be a super genius to see how you make a ton of profit.
Yeah.
And so it's like, there's almost this translation function of like intelligence and effort into profit. And the great business models are ones that have this like very high translation function for like the same amount of like effort and intelligence, you get this much bigger return. And I realized like, oh my God, like at Bench, it's like the number three player died, like scale factor, right? It's like, this is the translation function is like, there was a ton of intelligence around this business. Like I recruited all these like really, honestly, people that were smarter than I had any right to have on my team. Ex-McKinsey, ex-Bain, superstar people, analytical minds, like optimizing every part of this bookkeeping factory. And still it was like, okay, we are keeping our head not just above water, but like, you know, 5% above water. You know, there's a return function here. It's growing. It can keep being sustainable. But like, you know, Shopify didn't feel like we were keeping our heads above water. It felt like everything we did was just like entering into this infinite feedback loop, which is just going to keep on feeding back on itself. And just like being in there, you know, looking at all the other leaders doing their stuff. I'm like, oh God, like that's going to get multiplied by that. And that's going to multiply by that. And like, how does this company not grow 100x? You know, like, oh my God, it's so obvious to me. And I'm not even on the senior team, you know? And then there's probably all the stuff that's going on in Toby's head, which he hadn't told anybody because, you know, it's a public company, right? So it's not like, you know, you can share all the super secret plans around. I'm like, oh man, this is ridiculous. Like, and also B, why don't I just find a blueprint like that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why don't I find a really amazing translation function and get it rolling and get it started? With the unfair advantage of I'm also using my 10 years of accumulated experience in the space to find something that can, you know, that's how you build a multi-billion dollar company. Sure, having more genius to put into that translation function is important. But like what's far more important is the power of the business model itself, that translation function itself. So like how do you design that?
And that goes back to the thing that a lot of VCs will say is that like market matters more than almost anything else. Like you can have a great team going off on into the desert and like...
Well, this is something that VCs understand really well. And actually, I think entrepreneurs don't actually understand as well because usually entrepreneurs, like they haven't seen it 20 or 50 or 100 times. They've seen theirs. So it's like it wasn't until I pulled my head up and started, you know, being part of another business and then taking a look at some other business and how they run and going, oh, okay, now I understand why all these VCs were going, it's just not, you know, it'll be a good business, but you know, and they were right.
Yeah.
You know, they are looking for the stripes and they should be because that makes sense for their economic model. Now, there's also stuff the VCs don't get. Like, I want to give them credit. There's a lot of smart VCs and they get a lot of stuff a lot better than a lot of entrepreneurs. And there's also a ton of stuff they don't get and give terrible advice as a result. But that was one thing where I'm like, okay, I can actually, if I understand how this works, now I can much more intentionally design something that will be explosive in its growth and become a huge company. So that's you know, we're oriented a little differently this time with Teal.
Yeah, so you've sort of made, I think, a good argument for why taking that into account when you're thinking about what you want to start or what new product line, if you're an existing business, you want to go into, is super high leverage thing to be doing. And then you described vertical SaaS as an example of an economic engine where, you know, if you have your customer and you can expand within a very well-specified market. Are there any other ways that you think about how to identify something that does have that really efficient function of effort into profit and growth and flywheel? Or do you feel like what your playbook is with Teal is a different take on that idea of it being vertical SaaS because the SaaS companies that you're serving are vertical SaaS companies themselves?
Well, I think having the ability to sort of recognize those kind of business models, it's very different by the different industry you're in. Like, so consumer and enterprise are completely different beasts. I know nothing about them versus like the SMB industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the winning model in the SMB industry is vertical SaaS.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to find an SMB-oriented company that's at any appreciable level of scale that's not vertical SaaS. There actually originally it was sort of like the accounting companies, like Intuit and Y, because they were kind of the software that you ran your entire business on.
Yeah.
That was the original sort of run your whole business software. It's like, I'm invoicing through this, I'm doing all this kind of stuff. And it was not vertical specific. It didn't have to be because there was nothing before that. It was like pen and paper or like really crappy software. And then this comes along and it's kind of like the horizontal one fits size fits all. And then that gets chopped up into 100 different, like everyone, it's going to die a death of 1,000 cuts because like everyone can now come along and say, I'm going to build the best software to run a barbershop. I'm going to run the best software to run a nail salon. I'm going to build the best software to run a legal office. And they'll be able to do each of those verticals much better than QuickBooks. QuickBooks can't fight them all at once and win. Doesn't mm-hmm. matter how big they are. Doesn't matter they have 100 billion market cap. You just can't. It's like you're split too many ways. You have all these individual cultures which like live and breathe that exact customer profile. You know, over the last 15 years, this has been a model that's been discovered that it works and is repeatable. And copy and pasteable into all these different industries. So it's kind of just like this, you know, right now is the perfect time. If you want to start a business in SMB, what you should do is like go find some SMB which doesn't have a massive vertical SaaS player and just be like, can I just sit and watch how you like run your business and like build software for them? This is kind of the time. Like the 2020s, honestly, people don't talk about it, but like this is going to be the decade where a ton of huge vertical SaaS companies get built. You know, there's a few that have led the charge and developed the formula. And now it's like literally building a big company in this space is as simple as following the formula and applying it to a new niche. And so we need a lot of entrepreneurs to go do that. But like, and then you think of the second order consequence, which is what are all those companies going to want to buy? And that's where embedded fintech comes in. That's mm-hmm. why like, you know, embedded payments was the first, but like financial services is really typically the best way to actually monetize this vertical SaaS strategy. Because a lot of the monetization happens in a way that the customer isn't paying for directly.
Yeah.
So like if you give someone a card, like you're not paying to use my card, but I get interchange in every purchase. So it's kind of like invisible. Actually, the way you win in cards is just by having the customer use your card. So why should they use your card, right? And it's like, well, because it was by the company that you run everything else on, then you have this massive profit pool. Like it's so, cards are so profitable outside of the customer acquisition costs. And it's actually kind of true in financial services. There's so much profitability. And that's why you see ads for banks freaking everywhere and why BMO and RBC and all these, you know, it's like financial services is a really good business
and
to be in.
And a person with a desk just literally standing in the airport being like, you want a card? Do you want a card? Like that's very expensive.
And the only magic is can you convince them to use your card versus a competitor. And vertical SaaS has this magical ability to convince people to use everything of this brand name. This is for you. You know, this is your card. This is your payments platform. This is your banking. This is your lending. And all these reinforcing functions of like, I use the payments data to assess whether you're a good loan profile. You know, so all these things, you know, my loan losses are lower. You know, they're businesses, so they have a better spending profile. Like there's, so all these things kind of conspire to make vertical SaaS really potentially profitable and financial services the way to monetize that. You can also charge subscriptions, but like typically it's better just to get people in the door and then monetize them on the financial services because that's just such a better, like you pay nothing. Here, use my version, use my card, use my bank account. And you know, you pay nothing. You're like, oh my God, it's free or close to free or $19 or whatever. And it has all these things. And really all that's where I make my money, right? Is on the financial service piece. And then there's this, you know, what I was seeing, which seemed as plain as day to me, is like there's this big missing piece in the middle to pull all the data together, which is accounting,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, also A, it gives you another layer of insight into these businesses to help you sell financial services products even better, helps them understand their business and helps them make them more successful. It's another thing that increases retention because, well, now all my accounting's here. I'm not going to leave, right? So there's all these things together that just like make this financial services pie even more profitable. Like it just amplifies this whole financial services strategy. And it was kind of staring me like plain as day in the face because I understood both sides. I'd been on both financial services side and the accounting side. That's where Teal kind of came together.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense. There's a whole lot of opportunity I see as an accounting software tends to be non-industry specific and a silo where there's a bunch of data that is not necessarily, especially for a small business, obviously at a certain scale, you have your ERP systems or whatever, and then you have dashboards and then you're familiar with all your metrics. But there's so many small businesses where there's like, just they go in their accounting software and then it's like, they have a P&L that's maybe set up properly or whatever. But there isn't a loop from someone the way that there is for, say, Shopify. You know, Shopify understands that vertical. They understand how to run digital commerce so well, and they have so much experience and they have so much data and so much knowledge about how to do that well. And they have literally like millions of examples of like, oh, these businesses failed and these ones did well. And we can like learn from that, that if they were plugged into something like accounting, then their accounting system that you could be using in Shopify or whatever, you know, other vertical, or Jane is like one that I'm familiar with here, you know, they're doing for medical practitioners, the way that they would look the finances of their business would have a different valence than the way that somebody is doing e-commerce. And if you can provide that an experience that even if it's not that different, but it highlights a couple things, and then it doesn't have this big, big question mark here where you're, oh, my clinic has $0 of inventory. Yes, of course it does, because I don't have inventory because that's no kind of 100%. Business I am or whatever.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It just works out of the box. It just feels magical because it's just like, oh, this is for me.
Right.
Like that's when people really influences a buy decision, is when someone sees that thing and they're like, oh, that's for me. Like, of course I should be using that. That's the one for me.
Yes.
Right? It influences the antiperspirant I buy. Ah, for men.
Yeah.
It's probably the same damn
chemical. Probably exactly the same ingredient.
But I'm always like, oh, I can't buy the women's antiperspirant. You know, that's for women. It's like, what? Like, the only thing that makes it different is the packaging and the branding, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can go further than just packaging the branding and actually add in these things that make it differentially better for that segment. Accounting is about to get very, very verticalized. And it's just starting to happen now with banking. Like banking as a service. Not everyone's, yes, you know, in fintech. So it's this middleware layer where, you know, anyone can basically spin up a bank. And they're not actually the bank. There's a bank on the back end, but you get to be sort of the front door and like look like the bank and have your brand on it. But everywhere, you know, you have to say, the actual banking service are provided by XYZ Bank, right? And you have a partnership on the back end. But like what we're seeing now is bank as a service only really became possible in, call it 2020, 2021. Like it was technically possible for a few years before that, but it was just so ridiculously hard and legacy and all these kind of things. But then like this new generation of providers came on the scene, really pioneered by this company called Synapse, and I would say mastered by a company called Unit, which again, Synapse is the early mover, but having a lot of trouble. And now Unit and Stripe Treasury are the ones that everyone's
right.
kind of,
you Stripe know, Treasury, I've definitely heard of in that
space. If you're going to do B2B, SMB banking or SMB cards or something, like those are the two providers. And like, that's super recent. You know, it's like been around for 18 months, and the number of like new banks that have spun up and are already, it's something like 50% of new small business accounts in the US are neobanks now.
Really?
Right? And you're like, wow, it's been like from 0 to 50% in 5 years, right? But one thing I think the neobanks are missing is like, they're like, hey, it's possible. Let's go now to SMBs. Boom. And all you had to do was be better than the banks. But I think the next generation after that is the vertical SaaS players that come in and go like, yes, and it's not just SMB. SMB is not targeted enough. It's roofers, you know?
Right.
It's like dentists. It is like these various, you know, nail salons. There's this thing as an SMB. Like business owners aren't like, I'm an SMB.
No.
Like, my brother installs windows. You know, he's a window installation contractor, right? He's not an SMB.
I'm a restaurant. I'm whatever.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. When someone comes along and offers them banking for restaurants, and it has a few of these little add-ins, which is like specifically for restaurants. And by the way, the more banking you do, the more we're going to understand, you know, if you're eligible for, I don't know, I'm not a restaurants guy, right? But whatever specific stuff for them, you know, I'm not sure if they take loans or what. This is the whole point, right? Each of these is so different that the company that's in that space discovers that, well, there's one or two things that they offer specifically for them that makes it that everyone wants to buy it. So all this stuff's going to get specific. It just started happening with banking. And now everyone's got all this banking data. Well, what do you do with the banking data? They're trying to send it over to QuickBooks. That's really hard and bad. And they're starting to go, well, I got all the banking. Why don't I just do accounting myself? Well, we're actually starting to see a lot of people that are reaching out to us are actually like banking and card for specific verticals. Like it's vertical SaaS that are actually starting with banking, like for a specific vertical. And then they go, oh, and you know, one of the things you can do is issue different cards. And hey, what if like when you spent on the card, that could, you know, you could spin up cards at will and track different expenses with it. And then that would just go into your accounting. Like if I want to track like, you know, expenses by location, for example, okay, just issue that location a card, that location, that card, that location a card. And it just shows up out of the box in your accounting, right? Totally possible in Teal, just out of the box, easy, right? So it's like those, that's a lot of what we're seeing right now in terms of like, you know, the culmination of vertical SaaS and bank as a service and now embedded accounting, which we're offering.
I love it. So I just feel like I've just gotten an awesome crash course in vertical SaaS, and I'm going to be laying a bed tonight thinking about the impacts of the vertical SaaS revolution. But I want to, well, before we run out of time, I want to get back to this thing we teased at the beginning,
yes,
which is the idea of how you hire. You know, what do you prioritize? You're building a company culture. Obviously, we talked, you know, around it by talking about how you've learned that you want to prioritize hiring for, and you know, you didn't use these words, but I assume it includes also what you promote and what you encourage on your teams, a mentality of building a business that wins, building a business that's successful in terms of profitable, not just, you know, whatever. Every person makes up their different definition of success. And you've sort of come up with, I assume it's your creation, this phrase boring competence for that, and it's in your job ads.
Yeah, winning with boring competence. Yeah, exactly.
Winning with boring competence. Well, I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about what you mean by, especially the boring part of boring competence, because that's the most like sort of novel. You know, it obviously implies, you know, that there's some people out there that maybe have focused on other aspects of maybe what might seem like competence, but you have a specific mindset for it. So a boringly competent company culture look like to you?
Well, first I'll give you the contrast to start painting a picture, which is there's so many people that are sort of novelty seeking when it comes to startups, where it's like, oh, it's a new thing, it's exciting, it's all these kind of things. And I don't care about jumping from the rooftop and saying we're the coolest thing. I don't care about getting status at conferences. Like that's all, this is all superfluous. It has nothing to do with what we're trying to achieve.
Our whole team does yoga at 10 a.m. every day.
Okay. And like, look, if you do, great. If you don't, great. It's just that it just doesn't matter. Like what matters to us and what we're going to talk about is winning. And how you do that is just by focusing on winning. So let's just make it boring. Not all this other novel stuff. We're not going to talk about all the cool new, you know, technologies that we're going to use, implement. Like, look, if there's a new technology that's useful, use it. We use GPT-4, but we don't use GPT-4 because it's novel. We use it because it's actually useful for new applications, and we only use it for the things it's useful for. We're not like trying to use it for things that it would be silly to use it for. And then like, you know, putting on our website, AI, like you'll see, I don't even know if there's anything about AI on our website. It just says embedded accounting, and it's all about, you know, the benefits the customer gets. It doesn't even say AI anywhere there, even though there are applications.
That's
of it.
The way to actually market. If you build a product with AI, then like no one cares. Like it's, what does it do for you? Really?
Yeah, cool. It's like, oh, you built a product with tires. You built a product with, you know, it's like, what? Okay, is it going to get me somewhere? Is it a car or is it just, you know, anyway. And there's a whole lot of people sort of around the technology space that seem to be, I don't know if they actually want to be part of like the exciting business or if they like have to put that on because startups say that that's what they're doing. And we're looking at people who are so passionate about our mission and they want to like change the world by building better dog food or something, right? It's like, what are you talking about, man? Like, let's like get real. Like, what are you like? And like maybe the founder really believes that, but I guarantee you that the next 20 employees are just like, yeah, we're all going to say it. And like, it's kind of weird, but cool. I guess I'm into it. But like, why are you like, let's just, can we dispense with sort of like this like level of pretending that people have to do in order to fit into the weird alternate startup culture? Can we just say like, hey, we're professionals and like, we're trying to create a really big outcome. And like, if you want to do that, great. If you don't, great. Let's authentically look for people who it's like, Is building a really profitable business interesting to you? Yeah. Okay, great. Let's work on it. Like, we can get rid of all the ridiculous sort of like hustle porn culture. Like, all the, there's no bonus points for like sleeping under your desk. You know, it's like, do we ship really high quality code? Do we have happy customers? Like, these are things that matter. And none of the other sort of, I don't know, like, I for some reason right now, I have this YouTube video of like Jack Ma on stage, like doing a dance in front of like 10,000 employees at Alibaba. I think it's Alibaba, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, that's just so far the opposite of like, I don't want to be like doing the moonwalk in front of like 10,000 employees. It just seems so kitschy. Like what is this weird, almost outer space culture? Like, can we just be professionals? The outcomes we're working towards and the work itself are interesting enough without dressing it up, you know? And if that's not true, you should probably question what you're working on. People aren't at SpaceX because of the parties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, also, we're not pretending like we're going to make a bigger difference in the world than SpaceX. Elon Musk is the GOAT. You know, I'm not going to be able to do that. And I'm not promising anyone that I'm going to do that. And I'm not going to tell anyone I'm going to change the world with accounting. What I am going to do is, you know, we're going to orient ourselves to be really serious about building an incredible business that's worth billions of dollars.
Well, I don't know. You can imagine a branding of it that being exciting to some people, right? Like, maybe building something that where like, you know, you can imagine a different person with your same set of goals that you're expressing the idea, what are we hiring for? Is like people who are ambitious and driven to grow and make the company grow. You know, I don't know. Different people might have a different idea of what boring competence is that may or may not lap. Like, some of the things you described there are not boring. And other people, I'm just being kind of devil's advocate on that, is like something about, you mentioned, you know, sleeping under your desk level and like overwork is not part of your vision on that. And but a lot of companies, like, you know, that is the vision. And I feel like that's a potentially compelling thing when you're trying to recruit people. Like, hey, you're at the scale now, maybe you're not at the point where you're trying to get your marginal 100th, or you're building an exec team and it's maybe more challenging to get attention of people. But at mm-hmm. a certain scale, I think the reason why a lot of companies end up on the path that you maybe were at eventually when you're going in there on a podcast talking about some cultural ideal that you maybe don't hold anymore is that they're trying to get great, talented people at scale.
Yeah.
And they want ideally to have some pre-filter for a type of people who think in a certain way, which is what you're doing, I guess, with boring competence. It's just sort of, I guess, an anti-authoritarian, but like a counterintuitive way.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. And I mean, the last thing is competence. So let me put the last piece in there and then we can talk about all three together, which is people should be really good at their job. And we just have an extremely high bar, and no one gets hired without being really extremely good at their job. And I think most companies are not good at doing this. I think most founders try to convince themselves that they're getting the best talent, and they don't actually pay very well. And they think that the best talent doesn't understand what they're worth, and the best talent can be fooled by your changing the world with dog food level sort of like ridiculousness. When really the best people are just somewhere else. And in fact, you've never even met the best people because they're not attracted to what you're offering. And you have nothing to measure against. Like, I was very lucky in that I went to Bain & Company as my first job at university, because that is a company that attracts some of the most incredible talent right out of school. And like, you know, a lot of people that were in my starting class at Bain & Company, one is right now the number three, or like, you know, top five people at Uber, for example. Another, you know, three are CEOs. This is out of a 10-person group, by the way. Three are CEOs of successful startups as measured by, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in equity value. Like, so, you know, when you're in a concentrated group of these people just like brimming with potential, like, it feels different. The kind of conversations in that group feels different. Like, the level of conversation, the level of analytical rigor we got into when we were doing cases. I don't agree with everything that being a company does or how it approaches things. It's a very different business. But one thing I just have to expect is the competence bar. And that is now always sort of like permanently burned in of like, that's what competent looks like. And it's something that I can refer to. And quite frankly, at Bench, for a lot of the folks, I did get those. But then for a lot of positions, I didn't. And it was kind of, there's always this sort of like thing in the back of my head around like, I don't know if these are actually the best people. Like, that was, you know, for some of the roles, for some of the people, and I didn't really take action aggressively to raise that bar. And I don't even know if actually it's possible in a business without like a ridiculous profit profile to get the best people because we couldn't pay. I'm having this moment where like I'm trying to love all my children because I do respect the hell out of what Bench is and all those kind of things. But I have learned a lot and there's a lot of things I'm going to be doing differently, right? And one of them is the pay, where like the lowest paid engineer at Teal is paid higher than the highest paid engineer at Bench, you know? So like right out of the gate, you're going to get access to a different talent pool because there's people who are, you know, they're really, really good. They're at like AWS or Facebook or Netflix, and they want to do something different. They don't want to be part of a big machine. They do actually really want to do this winning with, you know, there's something to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to be on a small team and we're going to build something together and that's going to be great. And I want to bring my skills to the table. But like, can I really take like an 80% pay cut? But if you can make that like a 40% pay cut with a whole bunch of equity and something that could be a lot, it's just there's just a whole bunch of people that you're going to get access to that you wouldn't otherwise. And you can't get around it. Like, nor probably should you try to get around it. Around like super competent people are worth paying more. You know, like you pay twice as much and you'll get someone who can produce 10 times the outcome. So that translation function works. And then if you pack your company full of those kinds of people, like A, everyone looks around and goes, oh, this is the bar. And B, it's really like, you don't have to dress it up. Like, it's just great to work with a group where every single person you look around and you're like, I feel like I have to up my game because everyone here is so good.
It's so powerful working with people who are really excellent at what they do. And like, I've had this in my career and I've seen it happen to other people. Like, it'll shake someone. And their own career will never be different or never be the same from working with a group of people that all not only like it's one thing to work with someone who's really competent, which can have a big impact on you, but then working in a group where everyone else is operating just at another level. And then you realize that all this stuff that I was doing before was all just not at my own capacity because it seemed like I was doing better than the examples I had seen, but it was actually really just, you know, not, I just wasn't getting challenged or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's something I really feel like that's undervalued, I think, in a lot of companies is that idea of the return and the compounding effect of talent and all the things that go into that competence and also, you know, people who care. Because sometimes you have people who are nominally competent. They're in theory, they could be doing a good job, but for whatever reason, either they aren't motivated by the dog food mission or there's 100 different reasons. They there's too much bureaucracy. They feel
I'm gonna get a real nasty email from some dog food company after this.
We really are changing the world.
That's the kind of thing that's real, it's visceral, and you can't dress it up. And, you know, this feeling of also like everyone's competent and everyone's professional. There's not like ridiculousness. Like you can just have real conversations with people. What are we actually here to do today? Everyone is like actually serious about doing their job and not like not serious as in stuffy. Serious as in like, yeah, let's freaking do it, guys.
Charity Majors, who's the CTO of, or maybe now CEO, now CTO of Honeycomb. She was on the show and she, the term they use for that is we hire adults.
Yeah. And like we have a very short, by the way, culture doc. It's like 8 sentences. And it starts with our mission is to build a profitable business and our strategy is to win with boring competence. And it just talks a few sentences about winning, boring, and competence. And that's it. And it's like a quarter of a page. It's remained unchanged for over a year now since I wrote it before we start the company. And I think that we'll probably just leave it. Like, I hope that 5 years from now, that's still the culture doc. Because usually what I find is the people who are like, no, you need to add in, like, what about this and what about that? It's like, yeah, we're looking for people who don't need that spelled out for them. You know?
Yeah.
Like, well, you get this and you're like, oh, cool. That's it? That's really it? Great. Got it. Let's go.
The thing that I think starts to happen, I'm sure you saw this very directly at Bench, the motivation as you start to scale is you get some desire for some sense of consistency across an org. Whereas like you have someone who is a manager of managers that's hired some group and then you come across this group and you're like, what is going on with this team? They totally are not upholding. They are, I know, maybe they're all working 8-hour weeks and that's not the culture, company culture. Maybe they're all half competent, but they've somehow gotten away from being noticed or whatever it is. And you start to end up having more writing and docs and leveling guides and whatever, to the point of like Netflix, which I don't know how big away they were, but when they did their like culture doc of like, hey, and Netflix, I think, or I don't know, tell me if you disagree, but Netflix, I think of as a company that does kind of have that, hey, we're all, these are the top performers. We hire the best people. We compensate them well. You're going to be surrounded with people that are not being bureaucratic and arguing with one another, but are actually all like working hard to win. And, you know, basically sort of boring competence on a way. But they also have for a long time famously had this list of things, of behaviors that they expect. What is boring? What does competence mean to them? And it means things like actually listening when you get feedback and stuff like that.
Sure.
So I don't know. I'm curious whether or not maybe we should schedule for 5 years and see how big Thiel has got and how far the doc has grown.
You know, my counterpoint is being a company where you didn't need all that stuff. And quite frankly, I never came across groups where I was like, how did this person land here? Because writing a longer document doesn't actually solve that. What solves that is leaders actually making the hard decision of like, okay, A, these people can't be here. Like, it's just like people who are that good, they're not going to stand for not doing great work or being on a team that's just, they're going to agitate. They're going to talk to someone, like they're going to cause some kind of difference to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And like, typically if you found that, it's because you made a wrong hire somewhere, or wrong hires more likely. Writing longer docs doesn't change that. They're just the wrong people. Writing a doc doesn't change the people that you've got in your company. Only hiring and firing does that. I actually have the doc right here. The last two lines, the line of our competence is, every Thiel employee is required to be intelligent, effective, and conscientious. We hire people who are and fire people who are not. And, you know, a lot of people read that line. They're like, oh my God, you're talking about firing in the doc. It's like, okay, well, what company doesn't fire people? Right? Like, I know a couple and they're not doing very well. So if you don't put that in your culture doc, then you do it and you don't tell people about it. You just, like, this is the reality of our business. You're just going to kind of sweep it under the rug.
I mean, that's something that like our, you know, Esteem Clock were a little more fuzzy than that, the way we word it, in terms of, you know, we say, but that idea came from, to me, from Netflix of like, here's our culture doc, and it's explicit in their culture doc. It's like, your culture doc isn't very useful or meaningful if it's not affecting how you hire and fire.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, ideally, you're doing a good job of hiring and you're doing a good job of coaching and, you know, helping people find their good place so that you're not just quickly hire, fire. Like, you know, there's other ways of supporting people other than just binary. But if at the end of the day, not doing these things will not lead to you eventually getting fired, then the culture doc is meaningless. Then it's just a wish on the wind, right?
I don't think so.
You don't think that the culture doc needs to represent how and why you fire people in order for it to be effective?
We're looking for people of exceptional competence, and most people are not a very good judge of their own competence.
Yes.
So it's not like I can go around saying like, don't be incompetent or you're going to be fired. That's not really up to them. People show up with kind of the skills and behaviors and effectiveness that they have. And like, sure, you can coach, you can do all these kind of things, but like, we have a very high bar for when you show up on day one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if someone is not able to perform up to our standard on day one, explaining to them competent in a culture doc is not going to help. It's like, we made a hiring mistake, so we got to fix it.
Yes. And I'm not saying that the culture doc has to provide everyone, in order for the culture doc to be impactful, it has to provide everyone with a map of how to get to conforming to the culture doc. But that if the culture doc says, we hire people and we retain people based on their competence, and if you're not competent, intelligent, and having an impact, the way you phrase it, then you're going to get fired. Like, that's kind of is underlying. My point was that the doc is communicating how you think about hiring and firing. And as long as you're actually maintaining that, it may or may not be actionable to a person who's been hired.
100%.
Warning, you should be competent. And it's like, I think I'm competent. Oh, it turns out in the regard of the person who hired you, you weren't. And so then you're not going to stay. But as long as you're actually enforcing, as long as you're actually using hiring and firing with the mindset to this culture that you're building, you're going to end up building a culture that's informed by that, is my point.
Yeah, and like, I think some people read that and like they hear an implicit threat, you're going to get fired or something like that, when like that's not what this is at all. Like, this is just like, firing happens at all companies. This is the situation in which we do it. Like, we're just going to be open about it. And that also sets a tone that like, you know, when someone is exited from the company, it's also not a big deal. They're not a bad person. There's no like untoward thing that went on. We got a ridiculously high bar. Most people are not going to meet it. And so it's kind of normal. Yeah. Okay. Like, they're a great person. Didn't work out. We both thought it would be a fit. We gave it a shot. It didn't work. And now they're going to go do something different. And they're going to be just fine. And we're going to be just fine. And they're probably a great human being. Like, part of this doc is actually to reduce that sort of emotional heft of letting people go, because too many companies and too many managers, like, keep people around. They're like, I know this person is probably not going to work out. And they keep them for like 6 months or 3 months or whatever. Like, oh, I'm going to coach them. I know they're never going to make the bar, but I'm going to coach them. It's like, why? You're wasting company resources. You're wasting your own emotional resources. They're not going to be successful here. So, and, you know, you're dragging it out, the inevitable, for everybody. And it's, I think a lot of it is just because, it's almost procrastination around, like, you know, it's going to be a crappy day when you have to let the person go. It's the least favorite thing that I do in my job, is letting people go. And I know I have to do it or else we're not going to win. But I always have trouble sleeping the night before, and I always get like all this anxiety before the meeting, and I'm like, oh, this sucks. And it's the number one thing that I would put off if I had the opportunity. And so, like, part of this is like, it's okay. You don't have to go through all that. You're not a bad manager for letting people go. Like, just it. I don't envy you, but you got to do it. So that's part of why this is there too.
And that's the Netflix idea. Like, that's really woven into that doc, and talking about is like, this is not a family. It's a high performing sports team, right? And You know, players will come in and will remember them fondly for their contributions. But part of the job is that mechanism. And I think there's something interesting about this trend. At least it seems to me like a trend from my perspective of startups doing this. We only hire senior people. You didn't use that phrasing, but you're talking about compensating people, you know, 50% more, or maybe even double the median, you know, startup salaries, to get what you see as the most competent people. Presumably, you'll have probably a smaller team, or you definitely, for a given funding level, you'll have a smaller team. And so, but there's a bunch of benefits we talked about. But one of the things that I've seen in teams is that there tends to be a much more emotional willingness and ability of people to say, this is working or it's not working, right? When you have somebody who's senior and they've done this for 10 or 20 years, and they worked at this company where they know what they're doing, and they come in, and if they're not being effective and you're paying them $275,000 a year, then it's like, okay, well, it didn't work. We're not going to just like keep them on. Whereas, like, one of the challenges.
Yeah. Oh, I really wish I didn't have to pay this person $400,000 a year when they're not even delivering $100,000 worth of value. But, oh, my mistake. Now it's my cross to bear. You know, like, no, it doesn't. That doesn't fly.
Whereas you get a whole bunch of interns and you're paying them all like whatever the legal
exactly.
minimum
is.
Exactly.
It's totally different, right? Like, how could you expect like incredible world level performance from a student that you're paying $20 an hour who's never done the job before, right? It's just.
And it's so crushing to a student or somebody who's in the first couple of years of their career. It's so much on them to, if you let them go. And so you have people, whether or not they're doing just out of procrastination or really earnestly, you'd be like, well, I feel like they're probably not going to work out, but like, it's not, I haven't done as good of a job as I could have, or we haven't done as good a job of supporting them. I can think of at least a couple paths where they could pull it through. And so you end up with way more emotional labor and way more work going into. Obviously, the upshot of that is that sometimes you get exceptional people who had a lot of potential and then they work out. But it has a cost.
Yeah, I mean, building a company, designing a company culture is like designing a plane. Like, there's no one right kind of plane. But you better make sure all the parts friggin' fit together or you're going down.
Yeah.
Right? You can build a jetliner. You can build a Cessna. You can build a glider. There's so many different potential designs. And they should be fit for purpose. Like, the kind of company culture we're building is not a fit for, like, a corner store or a small business, right? Like, we're very intentionally going, this is the design of a business that is going to be a multi-billion-dollar software business. It's very intentionally designed from business model up, from every single individual, from the venture capital bought on board. Like, all these things very meticulously fit together in a particular way. And if you sort of, like, change one part out, it wouldn't work. Again, there's no one right or wrong culture. It's just sort of like, what mission are you going on? What does this plane need to do? You know, how far does it need to fly? How much fuel does it need to hold? How many people need to be on board? How fast do you need to get there, right? So, you know, that's, I guess, the overall point on culture, where what I see most people doing is sort of like taking accepted wisdom, not really understanding aerodynamics when they're designing the plane, and just sort of like copy pasting designs from different CAD files and being like,
I like this one and I like this one. I heard this sounds nice.
Oh, and one of the things that you have to do to have a great culture is profess complete confidence in the culture. So now I'm also not able to admit that it's wrong. You know, it's no, wonder that so many of these cultures are dumpster fires, right? But it's also like people doing the best they can, and they haven't even figured out the idea that like maybe you should intentionally design this to understand how the parts fit together a little better. Whether venture capital is right or wrong, there's no, again, jet fuel is great if you're building a jet. It's not great if you're not building a jet. That's going to probably be very volatile and blow things up. So it's not VC's fault. That's just they're providing, you know, it's not the fault of the jet fuel salesman, right? Like, don't blame the jet fuel salesman if the jet fuel blows up because you didn't have the right machine for it to go into.
Don't put jet fuel into your restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. Not probably going to be a bad outcome.
Awesome. Well, this has been a lot of fun, Ian. I have enjoyed talking this stuff through, and I've also appreciate you letting me challenge you, because I feel like it's then turned into more interesting.
Well, that makes it way more fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So this has been great. How can people go to find out more about you and your work?
Our site is teal.dev. You can also find me on LinkedIn. Again, my name is Ian Crosby of Teal. It's probably enough to have me pop up on LinkedIn. Really great to be on the podcast. Really appreciate you having me.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you making the time. It shipped that way. Is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steam Clock. That's it for today. You can give us feedback, follow us on social media, or rate the show by going to itshipped.fm/contact. We'll also have the show notes and the links that Ian mentioned here on the show on there. Until next time, keep shipping.